Yeah, from there, on, well, I guess in the late 20s and through the 30s and so forth, where the members of the board were generally picked for their expertise in some particular field. I mean, he would bring people onto the board. Well, he would he wanted one contractor, and of course he was a doctor, and then he had an attorney and so on, and people who could cover a whole range of problems that the zoo might encounter. And it operated pretty much that way up until, quite recently. But they haven't quite followed that process, but it has been followed to a degree.
Mm-hmm. I was interested also, I know he went on travels throughout the world visiting zoos, and I was interested in what sorts of applications did he or ideas did he bring back that he applied to the zoo in terms of the architecture, the grottos and so forth, from other zoos that he saw? What were some influences on his design of our zoo here?
He had a vast influence on the design of everything that went in there up until the time that he died. Every place that he went through every zoological park in every city that he came to, and he photographed all of them, and he brought back photographs, and these ideas were put together to develop the type of exhibit that we have. I don't know. As I understand, we were the first in the United States to have the open grottos, and whether he developed that idea from something he saw someplace else or not, I'm not sure. I would suspect that possibly he may have developed the idea himself, because he didn't travel outside of this country really until the 30s. And those grottos, the original grottos, were put in the 20s.
I see.
So I really couldn't tell you where he first got the idea of the grottos, but I remember seeing photographs of the guys sitting up on the side of the hill with their Springfield rifles and waiting for them to turn the lions loose in the first grotto. Because nobody knew whether they were going to jump out or not. And of course, the first thing they did was to jump down in the bottom of the moat, and then they couldn't get out. There was no ramp that was built for them to get out. So they lowered a platform down there with ropes, and they managed to get them onto the platform, and then the guys, then they pulled them up, and they could walk off. But it was during the 30s that he really traveled and got to see what was going on in other zoological gardens throughout the world. He carried on a vast correspondence with people all over. I'll skip off on a kind of a side issue in a sense here for a second, but he carried on quite a lot of correspondence with the Sultan of Jaipur, and the Sultan of Jaipur was probably the world's richest man at that time. So when Dad went through there, well, the Sultan invited him to come and stay in one of his homes that were out on the grounds of his palace. So Dad stayed there, and one of the things that wound up his stay was a banquet. And Dad had always said, he said, there is nothing in this world that man has not tried to eat. And he would try just about everything that came along. But he told me this story, and he said, this one, he said, really got to me. He said they had this banquet And I gather from his description that there were maybe about 100 people at this thing, and there's 50 people on each side of a long spread of food, and they're all sitting on the floor and on cushions. And that they would pass things up and down this row. And if you did not try something that was presented, it was an insult to the Sultan. And Dad said this one deal that really got to him. He said they had a glass bowl with a glass lid. And he said this glass bowl was full of roaches, live. And these things were all running around inside there. And you had to take your chopsticks, and you picked up one of these things, and you popped it in your mouth, and you bit it between your front teeth so that it didn't wiggle around while you were enjoying it. And he said that one, he said it took him a long time to get around to doing that. But he said he did it. And I guess they're really supposed to be pretty good.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, just recently, funny thing on this story, that recently there was an article, I think it was in the Reader's Digest, about a fellow here that is, he raises roaches of all different kinds. And people eat these things, and they're fed a certain diet. So that... they become a delicacy. I guess they're kind of like shrimp or something like that. But generally, they don't serve them alive. Anyway, that was one of the stories that really, that I'll never forget that he told. And I don't know whether there's another one that's a little bit kind of on the gory side that happened in the early days of the zoo. And This fella came into the zoo, and I guess he introduced himself to my dad. And there was a doctor here in town, Dr. Picard. I guess you probably run into his name by now. And Dr. Picard was a man who had a just there wasn't anything that he wouldn't do to put a joke or something over on somebody. As an example, Picard started the International Medical Association. And during Prohibition, all the doctors used to go down to Tijuana on Thursday, and they'd all go down there to booze up. And Picard would go down there, and he'd write up this story about the International Medical Association and their meeting in Tijuana, and then he would write a whole bunch of just gobbledygook, you know, just all kinds of stuff about it, and he'd send it to the AMA. And the AMA was publishing the minutes of these meetings down in Tijuana for years until they found out the whole thing was a hoax. And Vic had all of the newspaper articles about it and all the rest of the stuff, and he had them in his office there. So you can see that he would go to no end to do something that would be kind of outstanding. Well, anyway, this guy walked into the zoo, and he said that he'd been raised in Africa by the baboons. And he would like to go and talk with the zoo's baboons. So it happened that Frank Buck, bring him back alive, Frank Buck was the head animal keeper at the zoo at the time, and Picard was there, and so Pick and Frank Buck and this guy, why they sit down in front of the entrance of the old zoo there, where the penguin pond was, on right in front of the monkey quadrangle. And this guy said he wanted to go down and see the baboons, so they took him down there, and he said then he wanted to go in with them. Well, that kind of jarred everybody, and they didn't know whether they should let him in with these baboons, because if you ever fool around with them, they are strong. And they got big teeth. so So anyway, what Pick says, sure, go ahead and let this guy go in there. So they did. They let him go in the cage. And these baboons got in there, and God, there's all kinds of chattering, and this guy is chattering with them. And finally, when he came out, they said, well, how did you get along? And he said, well, he says, fairly well. He says, they speak a little bit different dialect than you. So they went back up and sat down on a bench up there by the pool in front of the monkey quadrangle. And Pick asked this guy, he says, well, he says, when you were in Africa, he says, how did you eat? And the fellow said, oh, he said, I'd run down a rabbit occasionally, and he says, I'd chase down a small game. And so Pick says, well, he says, are you hungry? And the guy says, yeah, I guess so. So they sent Frank Buck down to a little cage that we had right down by the monkey quadrangle there, and we had little rabbits and guinea pigs there. And Pick comes back, or Frank Buck comes back with a guinea pig, live one. And they hand it to this guy. And Pick says, go ahead. He says, have your lunch. And so the guy takes the guinea pig by the hind legs, and he cracks its head over the bench, and Pick and Dad made him sit there and eat that thing. And Frank Buck got sick of his stomach and had to leave. And then the guy, he left, and you can find the newspaper clippings of his visit, and it was in the Los Angeles Times, and he went to Griffith Park and was living up in a tree up there and chasing rabbits down, and they had pictures of him in the LA Times and stories all about him after he left the San Diego Zoo and went up there.
Oh, great.
But that was another prize story of the early 20s.
That's a great one. Great story.
Yeah.
I was interested also, you were speaking about your father's travels, and I was interested in his collecting trips. I think he made 5 or 6. And I was there anything that, I have some things I'm going to ask you that I've been doing some research on, but I was interested in anything that, of those trips that he took, was there anything that really stands out in your mind, the unusual of things he remarked on? And
I can't really think of anything right at the moment now that you'd be interested in, but have you read his diaries?
No, I have not.
They should be in the zoo files. I think they have copies of them up there, and if they don't have, let me know, because I've got some of them here. And he writes very well. I mean, you can see his humor as he as he goes through and places that he's gone to and things that have happened to him. And in his travels, he never actually brought anything back himself. He would go and buy and collect, and most of the animals were procured through dealers, and so he would go and buy the animals, and then we'd send somebody from the zoo over to bring them back on a ship, and that's the way that he operated at that time. Of course, I can remember one time that he came back, and I guess it was about 37, and they had a shipload of animals coming in from, I think they left Calcutta. At any rate, I got the word from him that I was supposed to get this little fishing boat from a contractor friend of his, and the boat was always anchored just about opposite where Conakai is today. And the contractor said, well, we could have the boat to go up and bring these animals back, but his foreman would have to run the boat. So that was all right. My brother and I figured that would be a pretty good deal. And we went down, we got onto this boat, which turned out to be about a, I guess it was about a 35-foot fish boat. And the best it would do was about 7 knots. And it took us 28 hours to get to San Pedro on that thing. And we ran into fog. And in the morning, I didn't think things looked very right in the way the boat was going into the swell, so I went back to see what this foreman was doing, and he was steering a course 180 degrees right back to San Diego, so we had to turn around and go back up. And we got up there, and they loaded two pygmy buffalo and two warthogs onto the fantail of this little fish boat. And we took off for San Diego with them, and we were running right dead before the wind. And I'm telling you, after those animals had been on that boat for a month, they stunk. But we brought them back that way so that they didn't have, they would have been held in quarantine in San Pedro, and we wanted to get them back into our own hospital where we could quarantine them here and keep our eye on them. But that's kind of the way things operated in those days, and I was lucky enough to go on two trips, collecting trips that we made with Captain Hancock and Valero 3.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah,
about the ship.
That was an experience. I'll never forget that one. That she was 195 feet long. I guess probably one of the finest equipped yachts in its day. They had a whole research laboratory and everything on it. And she cruised at 13 knots. He had one room. There was one, I guess you'd call it a room, that on the main deck that went from one side of the ship to the other. And it was about 8 feet wide, and there were drawers all the way across on one side, and on the other side there were cabinets, and he had copies of every movie that you could think of there. So anytime anybody was bored at night, well, you'd have a movie on board, all in 16mm. One above that, there was fishing tackle, and you could go fly fishing or you could go for 1,000-pound sharks. I mean, regardless of what it was there. On the other side was guns and ammunition. There were guns and ammunition for anything you wanted to go hunting for. It was equipped. It was... I guess they said at that time that she had the finest navigational gear of any, even the big ocean liners. He had Sperry gyroscopes on it. Of course, all the radio gear that you could possibly imagine. It was really, really quite the thing. And in those days, today, a 40-foot yacht's got better navigational gear on it than they ever had. Of course, there was no radar at that time, so they didn't have any radar equipment. They had good sonar, but that was about it. But the trip I made was down to Guadalupe Island, and we collected elephant seal down there. They took these big crates. I guess they were probably about 20 feet long and 5 feet by 5 feet, and they put them right at the edge of the beach so that the breakers were kind of coming over them, and then they made wings like they drive cattle and horses into with fences, and we'd select the elephant seal that we wanted, and they'd shoo him down the beach and run him down into the crate and close the door, and then they had 50-gallon drums tied onto the side of this thing, and then we pull them out with a motor launch and take a boat crane and hoist them up onto the upper deck and bring them home.
Okay.
Dr. Harry was not a big man, but he had no fear of anything. And those elephant seals, those big bulls, when they'd raise up, their nose would be up higher than this ceiling. And he'd be down there with his hat right on underneath him, you know, and he'd swing his hat and he'd crack him with the hat and the things would lunge at him, you know, and he'd sidestep it. Scare the daylights out of me. But he'd drive him down the beach and hollering and yelling at him, you know, and when we got him back to the zoo, he'd go in and work with him and they'd be lunging at him and everything, and it didn't bother him any.
I remember there was a trip that he took, I think it was in 1940, to India, and there was an article in the Union, and it was the title of it, something to the effect of Dr. Harry arrested by the British authorities. It was for the use of a camera that he was taking a picture of a cart, apparently, in Calcutta. Do you recall anything about that?
Just vaguely, and I don't want to comment on it, because I do remember now that he ran into some trouble over there, and I think they took some film away from him.
Yes.
Yeah. But I don't remember just what all the story was. Yeah, England had gone to war, and so they were watching pretty carefully, I guess, what people were taking pictures of, and I guess he photographed the wrong thing. I do recall that I guess it was probably on that trip he got into Shanghai, I think, and he told about the people up on the roof watching the Jap planes coming in and bombing the city there, and how all these people would be out in these big courtyards, you know, and the Jap planes coming in and killing all these people, and he said nobody seemed to want to duck and hide. They all wanted to get up on the roof and see what was going on. So he was right with them. But I remember him telling about that.
I was interested also in that regard on the Second World War and any effects that the outbreak of the war had on his collecting. I know he died in 1941.
Yeah.
Before our entry into the war. But was there any effects that the war had on the collecting of the zoo?
No, I don't. Well, of course, during the war, I think all collecting was pretty much stopped. But just, and I guess he made about the last trip before we got into the war. So I think he probably got everything that he could. And he made another collecting trip down to South America, and I guess that was around 39. Did you run into that one?
Yeah, I will. There's some information about that.
Yeah. Yeah, he got quite a few specimens down there. And that one took an awful lot out of him, though, when he was taking all this medication for malaria. And I guess when Hancock picked him up, he was just yellow.
Mm-hmm.
So that was... Well, of course, I guess you probably picked up the thing that he had a bad heart attack and had to retire from his practice, and I think his heart attack was 1930, and they gave him 6 months to live. And he said the doctors don't know anything these days. He says they've got a lot to learn, and he says I'm not going to die in bed. They want to put me in bed, but he says I'm not going to bed. he didn't. And oddly enough, he had angina. And at that time, as I say, they wanted to put him in bed. But today, if you've got angina, you've got to exercise. And what he was doing, and everybody was giving him a bad time for doing it, was he'd come over to the zoo and he'd walk around the zoo during the day and he'd play a little golf. And he was doing just the right thing. But everybody in the medical profession was saying, hey, you better be careful. Mm-hmm. But it worked out for him, and he suffered a great deal in the last, I'd say the last 5 years of his life, well, even in the last 10 years, way, in some of his trips, way, he was a sick man even before he took off. How he did what he did is pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. But he was not afraid of death. He said, one of these days, why, it's going to catch up with me. But he said, before that happens, he says, I'm going to see all I can. It's kind of an interesting deal. He had medical insurance with, I won't quote the name of the company now because I'm not sure of it. But at any rate, if he became totally disabled, well, he was to get $500 a month, which in the early 30s and the 20s, well, that was a lot of money. But they had a joker in it that you couldn't leave the country. So he made a deal with them that he would take half of that if they would let him leave the country. So they said, okay. So he got his $250 a month, and he would travel on these freighters, and that's how he traveled around the world.
So yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, he made 3 trips around the world and 1 trip through South America.
That's fascinating.
You couldn't even get on a boat today.
No.
You know, another thing, I mean, to show his sense of humor, too, along that line, he was always having a Peruvian birthday. You know what a Peruvian birthday is?
No.
That's a phony birthday. And every ship that he got on, he had a birthday party. And when he'd get on the ship, well, he'd make friends with some of the passengers, and generally on a freighter with maybe 15 or 20 people on it. And he'd just let it be known that, let's say next week, such and such a day, when he was having a birthday. And of course, the first thing these people would do would be to go to the captain or the chef and say, Dr. Harry's having a birthday party. So they'd put on a big party. And he had one of these things. Every ship he went on, he had a birthday party. And he did it down when he had the San Diego Hospital and Clinic. He pulled it down there on the nurses. And yeah, they gave him a beautiful onyx fountain pen and pencil set to go on his desk, and they fixed him up real good. Geez, they were really mad when they found out he'd taken them. I remember another thing that I used to drive him around the zoo in his 1931 Cadillac coupe that he had. And at that time, when we had a food stand, or popcorn and candy and ice cream and stuff, right up near the elephants. And we'd drive around there, and they used to have these big boxes of marshmallows for the people that came up there and had picnics. And you get these big boxes of Campfire Girl marshmallows. And he'd take them over to Queenie. And I figured, well, he's going to feed Queenie a few marshmallows, but no, you just take the whole box. Give Queenie the whole box, and down the box of marshmallows would go with a wax paper wrapping and the cardboard and the whole works. And Queenie knew every time he was Dad was coming, because she'd be out there to get her box of marshmallows. Which recalls another another incident. My grandfather had, for some reason, and I have no reason why, he decided he wanted a couple of chimpanzees. So he bought these chimpanzees, and of course they were very young at the time that he got them, and so you could handle them pretty well. And he had a cage built there at his house on the corner of Fourth. Let's see, his house was on the corner of between Third and Fourth on Laurel. And what had been at one time the old stable and so forth, well, he built this cage where the chimps could be on the outside. Well, they grew up to be a little bit too much for him, and so he gave them to the zoo. And Bundo, which was the big male, he got to be a real big chimp, and he was.